This podcast of Word of Mouth is sponsored by
Dartmouth Hitchcock,
creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Doucet Survey,
serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England,
now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Do you remember the last time you sat down and hand-wrote a letter? And how did you write it? In cursive or in print? Americans today use email for almost all of their correspondence, personal and professional, which is why schools across the country no longer regard cursive handwriting as a necessary skill. Federal Common Core standards passed in 2010 do not require cursive, which has lawmakers in several states advocating to keep longhand script alive in the classroom, which has provoked a sometimes acrimonious debate. Ruth Graham is a correspondent for the Boston Globe, where she recently wrote about cursive and the Common Core. She's also a frequent contributor to Slate. And Ruth, it's great to have you back in the studio.
Great to be here.
So the Common Core standards do not have any requirements for teaching cursive. Some states are adding them. What's the status here in New Hampshire?
So New Hampshire, it was back in March, and a Republican state senator introduced a bill that initially would have required school districts to teach it, and then the language was softened to just encourage school district to teach it. So it's pretty toothless at this point, but does at least show there's interest and concern about the status of cursive.
I would say, I mean, I think people get pretty passionately riled up about dropping cursive. So what are the arguments for keeping it in the curriculum?
Right. So when I spoke to the state senator who had raised the bill in New Hampshire, one of her big arguments is that kids need to be able to learn to read the founding documents like the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence in the original script. So that's one of the big arguments.
Could they?
Well, the interesting thing is, I mean, the script that those documents are written in is really not that similar to what kids learn in school, learn to read and write in school today. So I think, frankly, even you or I mean, I learned cursive in school, but it would be, I think, slow going for me to read the Constitution in the original script. So I'm not sure how strong that argument is, but that's one of them that you hear a lot, at least in political arguments for cursive. The best argument is probably, and I heard this from an education professor out in the Northwest, that learning cursive and just learning handwriting in general is this rare opportunity for kids in the classroom to learn a very practical skill, but that also where there's this element of aesthetics. And there really aren't too many classroom staples where you're sort of combining that element of craftsmanship with something very practical. I think more broadly, there's a lot of nostalgia. I mean, there is this sense that cursive is maybe no longer so necessary. It is kind of disappearing. I don't have great numbers on the rate at which cursive is disappearing from the classroom, but there does seem like there's some consensus that teachers are certainly spending much less time on it. Some schools cutting it altogether. And I think they're is kind of this nostalgia for a curriculum that almost all adults walking around at some point learned, and now kids today won't. So.
Right. Handwriting, however, is still taught. This is just cursive.
Exactly.
That is not.
Yeah, manuscript writing is still very widely taught, and almost all of the writing that actually goes on in the classroom at this point is still pen and paper. So we hear these stories about, you know, classrooms where every kid has an iPad, and that's happening in some pockets, but it's certainly not the standard at this point.
And maybe the time previously used for teaching cursive could better be spent typing.
Yeah.
Teaching typing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, you mentioned the political side of this. The Common Core is certainly a partisan issue. Is cursive a partisan issue?
Well, I wouldn't have thought so before I started researching this, but it does seem to be Republicans, Republican legislators who are bringing this up and state legislators. So even just a few weeks ago in Nevada, a state senator also raised it. And again, a Republican. The interesting thing is that in some of these cases, it's paired with a requirement that school districts teach multiplication tables, so which aren't linked, you know, educationally in any way other than that you can kind of see this this nostalgia for a kind of 1950s style classroom. Mm-hmm. And even, you know, they're like Glenn Beck has gone on and on about cursive on his radio show. And so it does seem to kind of be this conservative rallying point. And I think part of that might be just pushback to the notion of the Common Core.
So back to basics, better than the
exactly.
Common Core. Right?
Yeah.
And if it was good enough for us, it's good enough for our
exactly,
kids.
Exactly. Okay.
I also learned from your article that cursive was not or has not always been taught in school.
Well, handwriting itself has not always been taught in school. So, you know, if you go back to the early United States, not even all men, let alone women, would have been taught even handwriting at all. And cursive itself kind of goes through these fads. So there are different styles. In the mid-19th century, you had Spenserian script, which is this very elaborate kind of flowery script, supposedly inspired by nature. And then in the late 19th century and early 20th century, there's the Palmer method, which sort of emphasizes efficiency and is a supposedly more masculine script. So you get these sort of backlashes to different styles. And then that has now gone out of favor for an even simpler version of cursive. So it is sort of subject to these, I don't want to call them all fads, but the values of the time kind of determine the style of cursive.
Well, that's so interesting to me, Ruth, because I'm clearing out my parents' house and going through all sorts of old documents, you know, from the 1920s to the present, and seeing the letters that they saved that were written in cursive, kind of hoping for some kind of clue to personality. Not always getting it, I have to say.
Well, the point of handwriting instruction, even though we value it today, when you're looking at those letters, you're thinking of, you know, you do see the personality coming through, or you'd like to see that. But in fact, the point of this instruction was uniformity, it was legibility. I mean, so the idea was that everyone would have the same handwriting, especially in the sort of pre-digital era. The point was just legibility.
I want to go back to that idea of cursive being taught is one of the few things that are in the realm of the aesthetic for a lot of kids and a lot of schools. You know, we have people who do hand lettering and calligraphy now. It's sort of in the realm of artistry rather than the utilitarian realm. And I wonder, is that the future of cursive, that it's going to be this specialized kind of thing that you pay people for rather than knowing how to do or read yourself?
I think that's very possible. And certainly the aesthetic of handwriting, I mean, you see it in fonts, you see it in, you know, invitations on Etsy and that kind of thing. So people still clearly really love the look of handwriting. And as more of us are unable to produce it, at least produce a beautiful version ourselves, I don't see the aesthetic itself going away. So I guess that's something to be encouraged by.
Well, Ruth Graham, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Ruth Graham, she's a frequent contributor to Slate and to the Idea section of the Boston Globe. You'll find a link to read her article, Fighting to Save Cursive from the Common Core. That's at wordofmouthradio.org. Now, we've also got some of those old-school blue-lined cursive practice sheets that you can print out and try your own hand at cursive. We wanted to judge the quality of our own longhand in the office, so the Word of Mouth team all wrote that classic sentence, "The quick brown fox jumped over the lazy dog," with very mixed results. You can judge for yourself what our rusty skills mean for the future of cursive instruction. Again, check all that out at wordofmouthradio.org. While cursive instruction is on the decline, a new method of communication is on the up and up. Emoji. Once added for comic and emotional embellishment, emoji are now part of how the world communicates, and like language, reflect culture and national identities. Well, the mobile app company SwiftKey recently conducted a wide-reaching study on how emoji are used across the world and analyzed more than a billion pieces of emoji data. Jennifer Kutz is head of U.S. communications for SwiftKey and joined us to discuss the findings. Jennifer, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Which emoji are the most popular worldwide?
Smiley faces, by far. So there's, as anyone who's used emoji will know, there's many, many variations of a smiley emoji, and we categorize them as either happy or sad, and the angry goes in the sad group. 44.8% of all emoji used fall into the happy emoji category.
How much does it vary worldwide, which smiley faces are chosen and which others?
Sure. So it does vary somewhat. The only language out of the 16 we studied for this report that did not have a smiley face emoji in the number one spot for overall usage in the language is French. They actually are very unique. Yes, in that over half of the emoji they send are hearts, which we were pretty shocked by initially. But most other languages kind of fall into a range of about 40 to 50% happy faces. U.S. Spanish uses the most sad faces, and Turkish uses the most smiley faces on average.
Well, that's so fascinating. What about Americans in general? Which emojis strike our fancy?
So Americans, didn't actually stick out in huge ways like the French do, or the Arabics use flowers and plants significantly more than every other language. We did stick out in a few kind of key categories. We do use the most LGBT emoji, and for that category, we put, there's two emoji that Apple created. One is women holding hands, one is men holding hands. We also put the rainbow emoji there. We use that 30% more than any other language. We also lead for kind of stereotypically female-oriented emoji. So the pink bow, the lipstick, painting fingernails, that's the category we lead for, as well as meat. So there's
meat.
Yes, there is a drumstick and some other sort of ambiguous looking meat with bone on it. And we lead for both of those.
The U.S. also leads in the use of the eggplant. What's the deal there? Is there something I'm not getting?
So it's only recently emerged. Just before this report, actually, we saw some media coverage on how the emoji, the eggplant emoji, is being used in ways that it was probably not intended. I will leave that to your imagination, but it's probably not a far guess from what you're thinking.
Well, I guess eggplants are big in Canada as well. Now, our neighbors to the north apparently have a fondness for slightly off-colored emoji.
Indeed, yes. Canada's beat us in many categories we thought Americans would win for. So some of these include the poop emoji, which we were really hoping that Americans would win for, but they did not. So that was quite funny. They use it double the average and significantly ahead of Americans as well. They also lead for, several things, including violent emoji, in which we put the knife, gun, the death skull, and the bomb, and that sort of a thing. Raunchy emoji. So I mentioned the eggplant. We created a category of emoji that we know are often used in ways they probably weren't designed to be, including cherries, the cancer symbol, which looks like two numbers, the peach. They use that double the average rate. They also use three times more sports emoji than the average.
Okay, so how about some other countries? Australia, Brazil, any biggies there?
Yeah, so Australia was also an interesting one in that they really seem to be a place where people indulge in a lot of vice and sort of traditionally sinful living. So they use a lot of alcohol emoji, so they lead in that category. So the wine, the cocktail, the beers. They use 65% more drugs emoji. They also lead for junk food and holidays. One other interesting thing is they lead in the mammal category, and that it seems to be because they use the rabbit emoji very often. And we heard from an Australian recently that that could be because the time period that we looked at emoji was over 4 months over the new year, where they had I think it was a football tournament, and the leading team, that's their mascot, was a rabbit.
Well, SwiftKey's really hit on something here doing this survey of emoji. Where do you think the emoji's going, Jennifer?
I think it is going to quickly evolve to be a lot more customized. I think we're seeing some of this, on the iPhone. There's a lot of new abilities for you to build in GIFs and, different stickers that you can send. It's just a much easier way to express what you're feeling. And I think we've all sort of, if you've used email in your job or in your personal life, I think we've all had those experiences where people misinterpret your tone or your sentiment, because it's very hard to communicate that just through words. It can come across kind of more stoic. Whereas with emoji, it's much easier. And so I see that just becoming more and more popular.
Well, Jennifer Kutz, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Jennifer Kuth, she's head of communications for SwiftKey. That's a mobile keyboard app, which recently conducted a study of emoji use from around the world. You'll find a link to read the study at wordofmouthradio.org. There are a number of words you will never hear me say on the radio. And even if by chance one of my guests lets one slip, a bleep is all you'd get. And yet history has seen some very powerful slurs and epithets appropriated by the very people they were once used to repress. In this piece, producer Caitlin Esch of the program Philosophy Talk explores why some taboo words are reappropriated while others remain forbidden.
Many years ago, Inga Muzio was working as a writer for an alt-weekly newspaper in Seattle. At the top of every article, she'd write word count, followed by the number of words. One day, she submitted a story and accidentally omitted the letter O in count and got an entirely different word. The newsroom was in a tizzy. Here's Muzio on the phone from Seattle.
That got me to just being fascinated with just the naked power of this word, you know? The responses it evokes in people is fascinating.
Muzio decided to write a book about the origins of the word and her quest to reclaim it.
Now, notice that the C word ought to be exactly parallel semantically to
Robin Lakoff teaches linguistics at UC Berkeley. She says that word is one of the most vulgar in the English language.
Of course, we remember that not all that long ago you were able to say penis on radio and television. But you couldn't say what Oprah likes to call the vajayjay.
But why name your book after a slur directed toward women? Lakoff says if done right, taking pejoratives and spinning new meanings for them is an effective way to take the sting out. For example, the word black was used as an insult for a few hundred years until the civil rights movement reclaimed it.
This was tremendously controversial at the time. Even among white liberals, even among some blacks, it was uncomfortable because it still carried those negative connotations.
There's kind of an art to reappropriating words, like queer. The word was taken by LGBT activists and repackaged as an umbrella term for sexual minorities. The reclaiming of queer was a source of inspiration for Andy Zeisler, the editor and co-founder of Bitch magazine. Bitch bills itself as a feminist critique of pop culture. Here's Zeisler on the phone from Portland.
We knew what feminists are often called, and we just said, well, we're just going to go ahead and call ourselves that before you have a chance to.
When directed toward women, linguist Robin Lakoff says bitch takes on the meaning that a woman is out of the control of men. That almost makes the word sound like a compliment, but we all know it's usually used as an insult.
The bitchiest thing you can do is take back bitch. Because it says you can't control me, you can't control my language, you can't make implications about who I am and what I'm not and what I ought to be by throwing these words at me. So if you can do it right, in the right attitude and so on, it's a very powerful thing.
I'm a bitch, I'm a lover, I'm a child, I'm a mother.
But that doesn't mean the title of the magazine doesn't offend some of the very people it's fighting for. Andy Zeisler says they've gotten many angry phone calls, like from mothers whose children came face-to-face with bitch in line at the grocery store.
The ones that are most interesting to me are from people who say, you know, I really support the magazine, but I'll be honest, I have to rip the cover off whenever it arrives because I just don't like being confronted with that word.
Zeisler says the process of reclaiming a slur is a lengthy one, and she doesn't think the word bitch is quite there yet.
You know, there's always going to be the need for a word that's used to try and put those women in their place. And, you know, up till now, it's really been bitch. It's sort of been the go-to word. I don't know if that's really going to change.
Still, Zeisler does believe that bitch has been defanged slightly over the years. It's not quite as offensive as it was in the mid-90s. And she hopes that bitch will follow in the path of queer. Though in the end, linguist Robin Lakoff says it isn't really about words at all.
They're just reminders about the position that women are in and how important it is to get out of that position if we can.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Ever binge-watched a show until you felt sick? If so, there's a word for that. Showverdose.
Ever heard somebody recount a chance encounter with a celebrity? That is called a fanecdote. As the author of the column That Should Be a Word, which was featured in the now-defunct New York Times one-page magazine, author Lizzie Skernick gave our unarticulated thoughts a name. Now her neologisms have been collected in a would-be dictionary of the same. That Should Be a Word. And Lizzie, it's a pleasure to have you on Word of Mouth.
Thank you so much. That was a wonderful introduction.
You once wrote that the neologism is the souffle of the linguistic world. Now, what do you mean by that?
Oh, I think I meant that it was very difficult to cook correctly, but when you did, it was delightfully light.
Yeah, I guess it's easy to fail or not quite get the recipe right in creating a new word. How do you do it?
You know, honestly, my brain does it really automatically. I've always rhymed ever since I was a little girl. I used to hand in my book reports in metered verse, and I really couldn't help it.
Did you have any friends at school, Lizzie?
You know, I went to a very unique public school, and so we were all weird. I think I had friends. Now I'm not sure. My best friend and I in college used to speak a kind of Cockney to each other, and you know, I do still sort of speak that with my son. You know, I call him Coffee and Scream sometimes. And it also comes from, I guess, the fact that I like to make puns. But it's really, you know, some people have a sort of a natural knack for rhyming, and I just must be one of them.
But you found a lot of inspiration for new words from our culture's online habits, including there's a whole slate of words that stem from Google. For example, Rugal, that's regret of a search. A hoogle, which is looking up a person online, a trugle, to use a search engine to resolve a factual dispute. Others in that vein?
Oh, lugal was, because I was pregnant when I wrote that one, and that was to use search engines to find bathrooms. that was really my favorite. I'm not sure it made it into the book. But yeah, and trugal, I was so shocked that trugal was not a word, because so many men have done that to me, and it just always ends the date right away.
Oh, you mean they'll be verifying something that you say to resolve a factual dispute?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, if I say, like, oh, Warren Beatty was in Splendor in the Grass. No, he wasn't. What are you talking about? And it's like, I don't know. I've only seen it 18 times, but I guess I'm wrong.
There are some other digitally inspired words that really hit home for me. Chorespondence, mail that you don't want to deal with. What are some of the other ones that come to mind for you?
Well, my favorite, which is actually the first word I thought up, and then one of the last words I thought up, I love smearch, S-M-E-A-R-C-H.
Which means?
To look up someone to find bad stuff about them. which I do all the time. It's like when you go through Facebook looking through an old enemy's photos to see if they're old and ugly. And I also have recently come to really like phygital. And I thought phygital, you know, which means to constantly be checking your devices, must be a word that already existed, but it did not. And maybe it just didn't, because this is just all so new. I mean, I was just thinking of how in college I had always joked with my friend that I would buy a computer once you could sort of fold them up and put them in your pocket. That's when I would buy a computer. And of course that happened. You know, I was thinking I could hold out for the rest of my life. You know, now if you showed us a picture of ourselves from 5 years ago, we would just not recognize these people walking around stroking these little screens.
And we're people who make our lives public online. That's where Sharonoia comes in, fear of what people are thinking of your posts.
Yes.
Another one I've experienced a bit myself, flagony, guilt over unanswered important emails.
Yes. That is, although I really need to think of that was sort of an old school one, because in Outlook, you still flag, but in Google, you star. And I think actually some kids might not even recognize that because they'd be like, flag. What does that have to do with emails? We star it.
Wow, it's moving so, so quickly.
I know.
Well, when you create these words, do you ever try make an effort to, you know, kind of subtly insert them into conversation?
No, I never do. I think I should, but I just never do. I guess to me it would be like subtly trying to hand my book to someone during conversation. Like, you know, what I more try to do during conversation is listen and see if something interesting comes up, you know, either from the way people are talking or, you know, I think I have I was childless when I started the book. And then by the end of the book, I had a bouncing baby boy. And so at both ends of the spectrum, Brattle was very important to me because mm-hmm. at first I was having to duck. You know, Brattle is to talk about your children often at length. And I used to just be running around out of the party trying to find a smoke when people started brattling. And now, of course, I'm just joining the group immediately and dominating it, you know, with whatever, you know, word my son has mastered that month.
I'm speaking with Lizzie Skernick. She's author of That Should Be a Word. It's a language lover's guide to chorgasms, povertunity, brattling, and other much-needed terms for the modern world. Well, you just explained brattling, but I'm really curious about chorgasms.
Oh, okay. Chorgasms are so weird. You know, I didn't realize that word is actually an Urban Dictionary meaning something that I did not mean. It's in Urban Dictionary, I think, to mean the feeling of satisfaction and completion you get when you finish your chores. And I never get that. I'm just exhausted. But what I meant it as is, you know, when you're in a relationship that's starting to fizzle, you know, you can be enjoying the act of love. But, you know, it takes a little work to get to the end. And I think we have all recognized the feeling of a chorgasm.
Wow, way to take that frown. Turn it upside down.
I know.
Well, you mentioned brattling, talking endlessly, prattling on about your children. There's a yes. whole section of the book that's bornography, and a noun yes. that means the vast media content about child rearing. A lot of words yes. needed for modern parenting. What are some of them?
My sister-in-law's sister is training to be a midwife, and she's very into natural birth. So for her, I made up birthy, which is, you know, to really love sort of the natural act of childbearing and pregnancy. And I actually I wrote a new one recently, which I hope will go in the sequel, which is called Bond Descend. Which is to suggest that, you know, any bonds outside of family, you know, are not as important. You know, when people say like, oh, you'll understand if you have children or you'll never love anyone as much as you love your child. And I have been bond descended to, and now I just bond descend to people constantly. So I needed a word for it.
Are there any words that you've created that you're especially gratified to have been picked up by others, you know, or at large?
You know, I don't think anything I've done has been picked up at large. I'm always, I guess Fidgetal was sort of picked up right away because when I did that, there were these like 4 blog posts about it the next day, which, you know, is a lot for just a word, I guess. But I love Skinjecture, which was inspired by the Real Housewives franchise. And it's to speculate whether or not someone has had plastic surgery. And that was one of my, I love the ones that have a lot of words inside them because, you know, that has skin, inject, conjecture, and sure.
I'm so gratified that I can add so many new words to my vocabulary. I really appreciate it, Lizzie. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much.
Lizzie Skernick, she's author of That Should Be a Word. And you can find out more about her work and suggest your own neologisms for the modern world at wordofmouthradio.org.
My name be Ice Cream 15 Star. My brother be Driver 18 Star. And my ghost brother, Mojack 5 Star, dead when I myself was only 6 years old.
Those are the opening lines of a remarkable book called The Country of Ice Cream Star by Sandra Newman. While one critic has called the book a sort of Hunger Games for grown-ups, Newman's dystopian epic may have more in common with books like A Clockwork Orange or Ridley Walker, at least when it comes to the language. The entire book is written from the perspective of a 15-year-old girl named Ice Cream Star, whose tribe speaks a lyrical and unique form of pidgin.
Most people, especially Americans, will immediately notice when they open the book that the language is really based on or strongly influenced by African-American vernacular English. But it isn't African-American vernacular English. It's my version of what might happen to African-American vernacular English if it were spoken only by children and teenagers who were constructing their own society in the absence of adults, of schools, of media, for roughly 100 years.
That's author Sandra Newman. The plot offers a little more context. In Ice Cream Star's world, a disease has wiped out most of the population. The only survivors are various tribes and communities of African American children, all of whom will also succumb to the mysterious illness called posies by their 21st birthdays. Ice Cream Star and her kind call themselves Sangles, and while they may not be able to explain their origins, Newman told us that they are descendants of Senegalese immigrants.
My mother and my grands and my great-grands been Sangle pure. Our people be a Taurinite sort, and we skinny and long. My brother driver climb a tree with only hands, because our bones so light, our muscles 40 strong. We flee like a dragonfly over water. We fight like 10 guns, and we be belled to see. Other children go deranged and unpredictable for our love.
Maybe you were told in a high school or freshman English class to write what you know. That's not advice that Sandra Newman took to heart. So we asked what inspired her to write in a voice so utterly different from her own. Newman says she tried to outline the book in plain English, but it didn't work. When she started to toy with creating a language based on African-American vernacular and French Creole and biblical patois, the plot and tone of Ice Cream Star started to snap into place.
I thought this is a form of English that's familiar enough that it'll be comprehensible to people, but it's distinct enough. It actually has its own grammatical form, so there's that kind of feeling of real creativity in the way it's changed and informed itself. So I just wanted to look at it as a model, and as soon as I looked at it, I thought, this is beautiful. This is absolutely wonderful. And I didn't look at it again because I didn't want to imitate it. The next day, I sat down and wrote the first page of the book.
We Sangles be a wandering sort. We never grow nothing from anything. Never had no tato patch, no cornfield. Be thieves and braves to hunt. A Sangle hungry even when he eat. Even when he rich, he still want to grab, rob. He hungry for something he ain't never seen nor thought of. We was so proud. We was ridiculous as wild animals, but we was bell and strong.
Newman created her own dictionary as an aid while she wrote the book, which in the end wasn't all that useful. Often she would fish around for a word or phrase and then come up with something random that fit. Among the most versatile words in The Country of Ice Cream Star is bone.
I come toward and say low voice, salut. Bon salut, say hey you.
Well, yeah, that one word, it essentially means good. To a French speaker, it's obviously from French, so, but it's spelled like the bone that you have in your body. So it means good, but it also, you know, it can just be an emphasizer, like be bone disgusting means is really disgusting. And there are a lot of other words that are like that, that either drift into the meaning of really, you know, like in contemporary teenage slang, like hella or something. So the word valley, which essentially means courageous or brave, also can be used in that same way to mean really. Or again, like many slang words in teen speak, a lot of words just drift into the meaning of cool. Valley can mean cool. Fury can mean cool. Wolfen can mean cool. And, you just see from the context when it's being used that way.
Did it always come naturally to you when you were writing in this language?
That's our producer, Taylor Quimby, who picks it up from here.
Or were there times where you had to go back and rewrite something that you had already done because you lost it for a little bit?
I would know when I was getting it wrong, and I would just be listening sort of to myself, trying to come up with sentences that were right for the language. Just as when you're speaking a foreign language and you're at that middle point where you speak it, but you don't sound like a native. You're trying to sound like a native and fit in. So it was sort of like that process of trying to fit into the culture and pass for a Sengal in my own book.
Salut. Bon salut, say hey you. Driver get his brother face. Slept far, my ice. The morning meal be by. Nay, been away and back. I come and hunker to the fire. Its woody breath come to my nose. Driver reach and touch my head. Hair grow beyond its braids. Be some old centipedes you got. I shake my braids to shoo him. Smile up weak. Sure, I look like any rotten log. Male's gonna fear.
Well, really the hardest thing is exposition. You know, like when I'm trying to explain the history of a city, for instance. So it's difficult to do that in literature anyway without it becoming boring and beginning to feel a little bit flat and factual. So if you're doing it in this dialect, which is already, you know, just a little hard to understand, you have to keep it even shorter because it's more of a task and therefore it has even more of a risk of becoming tiresome. So those parts would take me days and days to write a paragraph. And then I would get into my favorite thing to write of all is fight scenes, which I could just write pages of those all day long without getting tired, so.
Without thinking sense, I shoot. Yo, every child be shooting wild. Ain't aiming, only shoot, like slapping a stinging wasp in panic. Be along a second before I know, Kalash got safety on. Ain't rid no bullet. And I fall hasty, claw her switch with weirdo fingers, strange to use. See a child laying on his face, his neck torn through. Blood be moving, kicking from his wound. A girl crouch by him, rise again with blood in hands and awful face. Shout high and vicious, Eddie's dead.
What do you think a constructed language does in terms of changing the experience for the reader? How does that change the experience of reading a book, and maybe how does it add value if you think it does?
Well, I think it can add value. It doesn't always. I'm not a big fan of the section of Cloud Atlas that's written in an invented language. It didn't work for me. But I think in Ridley Walker or in Clockwork Orange, almost all readers who read those books find that it adds value. And for me, you know, obviously it makes it more difficult initially to read it, but it also adds an aesthetic quality to the language. Much in the same way that if you go to Ireland, the Irish accent and Irish idioms add an aesthetic quality to everyday life. So it's just everyday life, but it has this sort of beauty and strangeness to it. And also because it sort of sinks you into that world in a really deep way. So there's a kind of intense escapism about it, which I think you can't really achieve as quickly and powerfully in any other way.
Days that come been clean bonus. We keep to 495, a highway broad as any field. Got a twin highway the same, these two companion faithful. Together, they go stretch and snake across all unkept distance till they find our new Connecticut. Some places, both roads vanish, eaten by the growing wild. Look like the highway dived beneath a cliff of skinny trees. We see a road sign stood peculiar in a flock of birch, a lonely patch of road remaining stubborn like a mushroom. Then, without no visible cause, the highway start again, with only nibbling bush around its edge.
I've found in the past that when I read anything, especially that's written in dialect, that assuming that there's nobody around to hear me, I have a tendency to want to read it aloud to myself, to hear myself say it, to sort of make it that much more real. Did you ever do that sort of thing?
You know, I didn't, and that's because I cannot make it sound correct to myself. I'm terrible at accents. I'm actually a terrible actress. I attempted to be an actress when I was a teenager, so I know this for a fact. I'm a terrible actress. And it's interesting because we've just signed rights for an audio version of the book, and they sent over the first file of the narrator they've hired, and she's so much better than I am. She sounds so much more right for the book than I do when I do readings. It's terrible. It's really embarrassing how badly I read my own invented language.
That
That was Sandra Newman, author of the book The Country of Ice Cream Star, speaking with producer Taylor Quimby. And a special thanks to Logan Shannon for reading passages from the book. You can learn more about the book and read reviews at wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. In May of this year, 285 kids between the ages of 9 and 15 competed for the title of champion in the Scripps National Spelling Bee.
If you spell this word correctly, the Scripps National Spelling Bee will declare you and Vanya co-champions. None attack.
None attack. None attack. N-U-N-A-T-A-K. None attack.
Correct. That is Gokul Venkatachalam, who was named co-champion of the 2015 B with the word Nanatech. Alongside him, Vanya Shivashankar, making this the second year in a row that two spellers have been declared victor. Over the past three decades, more than half the winners of the Scripps have been Indian American, and an Indian American has taken the trophy every year since 2007. Shalini Shankar says that those public wins fuel a stereotype of Indian American students as dutiful and disciplined. She's a professor of anthropology and Asian American studies at Northwestern University and wrote about this prevailing belief in an article for Pacific Standard called How Do You Spell Stereotype? So this idea of Indian American students as terrific spellers is part of a long-standing stereotype. Stereotypes aside, why do you think this demographic keeps finding its way to the winner's circle?
It's an interesting question. It's a very recent phenomenon. If you look at it over the history of the spelling bee, which, you know, the National Spelling Bee started in 1925. So it's very recent that we see Indian American students dominating as they have. But I think it's because they've really figured out a few secrets about how to crack the spelling bee code, and they've been really diligent about applying themselves to actually accomplish that.
And part of the cracking of the code you mention is that many of the contestants are involved in what you call the minor league spelling bee circuit. How does that play into it?
That's right. So there are two different circuits, at least. In some regional areas, there are even more. But there are these spelling bees that are targeted toward children of South Asian parentage. One is through a nonprofit foundation called the North South Foundation, and the other is through a commercial venture called the South Asian Spelling Bee, which is sponsored by MetLife. And between these two circuits, children of South Asian parentage are invited to participate in regional bees held in up to 14, 16 different metro areas in the United States. And then if they advance in those, they get to compete in national competitions for those two bees. And this is in addition to all of the exposure that they get through the National Spelling Bee circuit. So they just have far more practice and far more opportunities to hone their craft.
How about the kind of particular culture of Indian Americans that might make them great spellers?
I think there are a few things that contribute to that, but it's also worth noting that this is a very small subsection, even of the Indian American population. This is a population that, in general, has valued science and technology and engineering far more than the language arts. So it is a bit of a peculiar thing that we're seeing this phenomenon happening. But in any event, some of the things that contribute to it are that many of these children come from homes in which parents are fluent in English. There are kind of social opportunities in which parents share ideas of how to help their children and coach them for spelling bees. It's actually a very complicated thing to prepare for a spelling bee at the level at which you could win a national championship. Mm-hmm. And so sharing some of that knowledge is actually a key part of how these kids get a head start in the process.
Well, let's get to your point about the looking at spelling bee stars as the quote-unquote model minorities. This is a term that's been kicking around for a few decades. But like all stereotypes, a woefully inadequate simplifications. So what does that miss?
I think one of the things it misses is the sheer amount of labor and effort and sacrifice that some of these students put into preparing for the spelling bee. So the model minority stereotype suggests that there's just something sort of inherent or almost genetic, so to speak, about this type of success and that it comes very easy. And what is worth noting is that these students spend an inordinate amount of their childhoods trying to prepare for and compete in this. And for every winner that you see, there are hundreds, if not thousands, of other students who have spent that kind of time who aren't actually getting this sort of recognition and accolade. So I think it takes a toll on childhood in ways that we don't really see readily when we just celebrate a model minority as being an unqualified success.
What is it projecting upon Indian Americans?
I think it's projecting upon them some sort of privileged success, and that success is only in contrast to other minorities who have not succeeded in analogous ways. I think that most of the time, currently, model minorities tend to be juxtaposed to African Americans, to Latinos, perhaps Native Americans, as being this group that unequivocally succeeds in realms such as education, in business, and in society in general. But what we actually see is that there's such great variance even among Asian American populations that often it's the way that people write about them that makes them seem model and that reduces those sorts of differences and also creates these very pernicious comparisons to other racial groups. Mm-hmm. It's important to note that Asian Americans themselves are not always, if ever, the ones who are promoting this vision of their own accomplishment.
Hmm. What comes with that stereotype? What kinds of backlashes against Indian Americans?
I think the ones that have been well documented are around college admissions. We see backlash of quotas being set where only a certain numbers of Asian Americans are permitted, even if their other qualifications are above students of other groups. We see this in workplaces with the quote-unquote bamboo ceiling, where certain types of upper management promotion or, advancing into certain realms of upper management is very difficult for Asian Americans to accomplish. But I think it's also important to think about the fact that a lot of the things that people project onto Asian Americans as model minorities are just that, they're projections. I think that they are a group that are plagued with very much the similar set of issues that other groups are plagued with. And also, there in all of these other racial and ethnic groups, you see tremendous success as well that doesn't get reported under this one heading. So it's just simplifying a very complicated picture of life in the United States today.
Shalini, the Scripps National Spelling Bee is coming up in May, and I just wonder if part of you as a scholar looking at this is a little apprehensive, ready to hear it all again, that Indian Americans always win these things, not quote-unquote real Americans. They're taking over, that kind of thinking.
I think that we do stand to experience that sort of social media response, but it does have to be taken into account that for so many years, most of the winners of the National Spelling Bee were white Americans. And so nobody thought to remark that that was odd, right? So we only notice this as a streak because it's a non-white group that has moved into a space where it was previously a white contest. And I think that that is always going to be unsettling, but to their credit, the National Spelling Bee is very even-handed about managing how spellers are treated, and it is really a minority voice in social media that creates these racist responses to the spelling bee. So hopefully there'll be enough counter response to it to keep it quiet or keep it in its place.
Shalini Shankar, thank you very much for speaking with us.
You're welcome, and thank you so much for inviting me.
Shalini Shankar, Associate Professor of Anthropology and Asian American Studies at Northwestern University. She wrote the article, How Do You Spell Stereotype for Pacific Standard? We do have a link to read it for yourself at wordofmouthradio.org. Thanks so much for your listening time today. There is so much more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org. And if you missed any of today's show, you can catch it in its entirety with the Word of Mouth podcast. There's a link to subscribe at wordofmouthradio.org, or you can search for Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes. And if you like the podcast, tell a friend. After all, the best suggestions travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Please come back for more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2, right here on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Molly Donahue,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
Our intern is Fiona Shea.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire
Public Radio.